Now entering Nerdist.com.
Big Pop Fun.
Welcome to Big Pop Fun with Tom Wilson, the podcast for people who like to listen to things. Things that Tom says, things that Tom's guests have to say. It's the podcast that gives and gives and gives and doesn't expect anything in return. Okay, that's not true, but it's free. Anyway, here's Tom.
Hello, everybody. Welcome to another episode of Big Pop Fun, the podcast. It's Big and Pop and Fun, and I'm Tom Wilson, your host. Well, the name of it is Big Pop Fun with Tom Wilson, and I'm him. Thank you very much, Jeff Harlan. Jeff is the announcer. Jeff is actually one of the premier, top announcers and commercial actors and voiceover guys in the industry. He's an old friend of mine, and he's been very kind in recording this stuff for me when I send him weird little intro things, and I'm trying not to send him a million different ones, just little different ones so we can have, different little announcer thingies. So thanks, Jeff, for that. Welcome to Big Pop Fun. And let's go on, shall we? Another magical sleigh ride of entertainment and wonder as we fly like a zephyr over the rough edges of our disappointments in ourselves and mount like eagles to the sky as we accept our yearning humanity and land on a soft bed of acceptance and forgiveness of ourselves and others. I have no idea what I'm talking about now. I know. I'm really stretching it on the magical sleigh ride, but it is, isn't it? It is a magical sleigh ride of entertainment and wonder, and you and I are going on it together. It's brought to you by, today, Big Pop Fun is brought to you by cold medicine, just whatever, Sudafed, Allegra, Afrin, whatever it is, because I'm using a lot of it right now. I have no idea. Look, I'm basically, as I've said on the podcast before, I am a nominally functioning bubble boy. And by the way, if I go into anything that I've said before on previous episodes of the podcast, please feel free to fast forward. I have no list. I should have done it. No huge database of where I said what, when, so I don't end up a crazy uncle saying, we heard the thing about. So I have no information, no recorded thing about that. So if I start repeating myself, hey, fast forward, get to the interview or whatever. So it's brought to you by cold medicine. I went to the doctor. They have the allergy tests now that are more advanced. I have been allergy tested beginning maybe when I was 4 or 5 years old at allergist's office. I've been poked, prodded, stuck with things, examined, sent to hospitals and everything. And still, what do? You go home and you just keep on sneezing and getting asthma attacks and just taking medicine and old man river, which seems to be my sinus cavity, keeps on rolling along. And that's too much information. And again, sorry about that. But I went to the doctor recently and another test where it was like, there's a number of how allergic you are to things. He said, wow, highest I've ever seen is 8 to 27 or something. You scored a 2,000. You're the most allergic person I've ever seen in 30 years of practice. Yes! If I'm going to get the gold medal, let it be in something useful that I can, use to help other people. Anyway, I've been talking to voiceover artists, old friends on the show, and this is one of those episodes because I've known Bill for a very long time now from the show Gargoyles, which a lot of people like. There are actually in those conventions and things, there are specifically Gargoyles people. So shout out to Gargoyles fans, and of course, but you know him from SpongeBob. We were doing a bunch of episodes of SpongeBob SquarePants. And early on when I was on the set or something and people's children would come, this was several years ago, back when Tom could be asked to do this and would actually do it for friends. But they would say, hey, Tom, our kids are here. And boy, they're big, you know, Back to the Future fan. Hey, could you do a little, you know, knock on the head, a little hello, anybody home thing? And though I don't do it anymore, I've called a moratorium because about almost 30 years of doing it all the time, you know, you get done with that kind of stuff. So I'm done with it. But I would do the whole hello, anybody home, and knock the kids around a little bit. And they had a lot of fun. Anyway, it got to the point where we were having a cast and crew party for SpongeBob SquarePants. And I made an announcement to Tom Kenny, to Bill Fagerbakke, to Roger Bumpus, all the cast of the show, to Carolyn Lawrence, who plays Sandy Cheeks. I said, hey, everyone's friends and family have been coming in here, and I've been doing the Biff Back to the Future thing for everybody's kids. Look, when I bring my kids to the SpongeBob SquarePants party, you're all doing character voices for my kids until I say it's okay to stop. So they were very gracious, and Tom Kenny did SpongeBob for everyone, and they got Sandy Cheeks, and we had a ball with Bill at Bill's house. Here's the thing about Bill's house. The party was at Bill's house, Bill's first house. Driving to Bill's house. Look, if you drive a little distance in just about every American city, unless it's New York City, because that's hours of just megalopolis, but if you drive for a while in any city, you're going to get to farmland or forest or desert or rocky crags or in Bill's house's case, all four. You are far from civilization at Bill's house, but you're in an absolutely breathtakingly gorgeous environment. It just takes a long time to get there. And if Bill needs a loaf of bread, you know, he has to send a message in carrier pigeons or something. So we're driving to Bill's house, and the kids are in a minivan, and we're going to this SpongeBob party, and the road that he's given us, you know, it's got to be wrong. This can't be the way to his house. The road is almost vertical. I mean, it's really, it's just, you know, the minivans up this hill. We almost stopped the car, you know, to take out some climbing equipment and a rescue beacon. We were way out there. And you think this has to be wrong because out that way, you know, Bill lives among some people with the skull and crossbones signs, or the, you know, no, do not trespass, all that kind of stuff. Intruders will be shot, whatever. I, you know, just way out there. So, you know, we finally get there, and he's got chickens out there, and he's got, and it's great. And he tells me, oh, yeah, Van Morrison lived up this way a while ago. I said, really? Van Morrison, of all people. Have I told you lately that you're rural? I don't know what he was doing. Well, it's a marvelous night for a moon dance, but we're alone because nobody can find it. Okay, I'll try one more. Hey, where did we go? Boom, boom, boom. I'm lost, amigo. All right, sorry. Anyway, but we've had wonderful times at Bill's house when we don't get nosebleeds and keep the rappelling equipment nearby. Bill is kind and gentle and big and smart, like me, except for the kind and gentle and smart parts. But we are both big. He is actually bigger than me. So Bill is big and pop and fun. He was Dauber on the show Coach for 9 years. He was he's certainly Patrick Starfish on SpongeBob SquarePants. And he is a terrific guy. I hope you enjoy my conversation with Bill Fagerbakke.
It's Big Pop Fun.
I'm so excited.
Did I? Are you? So it's Fagerbakke, right?
Fagerbakke. Fagerbakke. Fagerbakke.
Really? I mean, you accept
fake and
people?
Bake.
Because I thought it was Fagerbakke for a long time, but then it is correctly Fagerbakke.
That's not really relevant because it's not about what's correct. You know, my cousins in North Dakota pronounce it Fagerbakke.
Oh, do they?
Yeah. My mother decided, who taught first grade, decided she wanted to say Fagerbakke because, I don't know, it was phonetically more
to get a, to come across with the kids or something?
With the 6 year olds, I guess.
Oh, really?
You know? Yeah. So, you know, and then if you, Norwegians, I think, will say something like Fagerbak. Fagerbakka, maybe even, you know.
So are there umlauts or anything that, that have been, no. that are missing? No.
No.
No, no umlauts? No, 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 no.
No, no. Well, strange things.
Well, coming into this this new place that you have at an undisclosed location, but the fact is, even if we disclose it, no one would be able to get here.
Yeah, right. Good luck. We'll be looking for you because we'll see you coming.
Exactly. Bring a full tank of gas and some survival tools in order to signal planes because you really you enjoy living in very rustic environments here in Southern California.
Well, since LA's chief cultural trait is urban sprawl, that kind of you just go to the far reaches of that, and you can get up in some pretty remarkable areas here. You know, and here in this area of the Santa Monica Mountains features what I believe is one of those weird qualifications: the largest state park within city limits in the world.
Really?
Topanga State Park.
Oh, yeah.
You know, so there's a lot of open area, a lot of public area that is, I appreciate because I'm from Idaho and I like starry nights and,
yeah.
You know, it's quiet nights.
Well, to call your view from your house expansive would be an understatement. It's the mountains and the ocean. It's really, really quite something. So I wanted to start because when I thought about you, I thought about coming to your house once for a party, and you have in this place, it's still here, this large painting that is in your living room, that was in your living room of your other house as well, yeah. And it stuck with me because it's somewhat abstract and kind of rustic looking, but the figure is of a man, of a large man in the lower right of a very large square. And we're seeing him from behind. And he's wearing, clearly he's wearing overalls, like a farm outfit. And I just enjoyed the painting when I was at your house. And we talked about it. I said, yeah, I like the painting a lot, and I was looking at it, but I just had to have it. Because that's my dad.
Yeah. Every member of my family that sees the painting assumes we hired a painter to create an image of my father. I mean, it really is that remarkably accurate. It represents my dad. I mean, even not just the physical characteristics, but there's a certain gait and physical life implied in the character that is my father too. So it's a very special painting.
It is a beautiful painting and a wonderful thing to have because I mean I know that feeling, you know, when you see a painting and it just rings true about a family member or it looks like a person or it's just a kind of amazing. I'm glad that you got to buy it. Most paintings that I see like that are going, boy, I wish I could buy that. But yeah. I don't end up doing it because paintings cost a lot of money.
Yeah, that was a very special gift. Actually, my what's the term? Estranged spouse, I guess. She many years ago saw it in a restaurant, and immediately, I mean, she'd never even
really. It wasn't a gallery.
No.
It was a restaurant.
Barsack down in Studio City.
Huh.
She was meeting there for lunch and. She had never even met my father. He passed away. He passed away in 85, but she'd seen enough pictures of him that she looked up and just went, oh my God, it's Bill's dad. You know?
Wow.
And so she got it for me.
So it was at Barsack, which is kind of a, you know, fancy-ish place.
Yeah.
I'm always struck with paintings at now the most expensive homes. You know, you could spend $8 million for a house and leather, sofa, everything, but you must have some painting of a mud-soaked truck at a bar. Like, the painting has to be something really farming, and it represents hard work and people of the soil or something. I don't know why, though.
Balance, I guess.
Balance. Just say, look, I recognize that.
Yeah.
That has value. A life like that. I mean, I'm not living one like that. But
real life.
Yeah.
Yeah.
So what did your dad do?
Well, he, for most of his life, I would say he was a farmer. He was disabled for pretty much my whole life. He had colon cancer in his late 30s and had some really unfortunate procedures that left him in a frequently recurring state of pain and mm-hmm. infection and stuff. And he was constantly dealing with that. And then the medications would mess him up. But before then, he'd done mostly farming. And he grew up on a farm in North Dakota, which that painting could absolutely be representing North Dakota. Mm-hmm. You know, he spent years in the Merchant Marine, too.
Wow.
He was an extraordinary guy. He was a crazy guy. He would... He'd walk into a room and he'd say, "Guess where I was 37 years ago today?" I go, "I don't know, Dad. Where were you?" "Well, I woke up and there was a cold wind blowing out of the northwest. I was sleeping underneath a coal car outside of Phoenix. And this wind had built up a drift of coal dust behind my shoulders, and I thought I'd never been so cold. I got up and I had to take a dump. So I dropped my work coveralls and afterwards I pulled them up and 37 cents fell out of my pocket and I felt like the richest man in the world." he had left home when he was 16 in 1933. With his older brother Ken, and they rode freights all over the western U.S. and sent money. They worked harvests and what
happened. So 33, so the depression. Absolute middle of the Depression.
Yeah, yeah.
And he and his brother, and what did Grandpa do? Was this a farm in North Dakota?
It was the farm in North Dakota.
But no money.
And they had, you know, a total of 9 kids. And, yeah, you know, and the 2 older boys, which were my dad and my uncle, they were the ones that
took responsibility. They said, "Well, yeah, we're just going to have to go out there and find something and send it back since there's nothing here."
Yeah. Yeah. So it was very much a Steinbeckian, if you will, kind of life for them for a few years. And time in some of Roosevelt's Conservation Corps mm-hmm. Camps. He had some great stories, though. And he loved to tell them.
And he told them a lot, huh?
Yeah, yeah. And they were always rich with detail.
And this was, were you in North Dakota? Where were you?
I grew up in Idaho. Okay. In fact, we moved to Idaho from the Inland Empire in the 60s. We moved to Idaho because he had remembered southern Idaho when he worked the harvests there in the 30s as being a really nice area. And so my mom was a teacher, so she got a teaching job there. So that's where I grew up. But I spent summers on his farm in North Dakota, the farm he grew up on. So I really got a taste of that.
Yeah. Did you work the farm?
Well, I hesitate to say that. Sometimes I would help my cousins because my other uncle was renting it out. And so I would help haul hay and stuff like that. But I was never really fully immersed in the grind of a farmer's son or anything like that.
Because mm-hmm. No. Mom taught. In Southern Idaho.
So, yeah, yeah. So we'd have the summers off, and we'd go up there, and Dad would do some odd jobs here and there, and I would do odd jobs here and there, and sometimes he'd assign me jobs, and filling in the driveway or whatever, and I remember with pride the outhouse hole that I dug. 1 week, it was...
Pridefully, you remember pridefully now or even then? You're going around and look at the depth of that thing.
That was a perfect hole. I know that was 6 feet deep and
and we won't need to dig another one of those in a while.
this baby's going to be here for a while, and Dad would come out every once in a while and check up, you know, make sure I wasn't getting sloppy.
So how long did Dad and your uncle stay on the rails there? I mean, did it work, or did they eventually have to quit and come back?
It worked, and I the little details that you think of when you're older, and now my dad's gone, and I can't get those details. That's why I don't know. You know, how long would they push it through the winter, or would they just winter in Arizona and work there? I don't know for sure, but my general concept of it is that they did that off and on over about 5 years. That's my loose understanding. Uh-huh. Of it.
When you were a kid, were you? I mean, I know you were. I don't know a lot about you, Bill. I mean, I just know. But you were an athlete, yes.
Yeah,
because
you
were a big, strong guy.
I was Richie Cunningham. It was happy days. Small town, Southern Idaho. I played football, basketball, and track, and I was in the choirs. I was on the newspaper staff, and I drove a 53 Chevy, and life couldn't have been sweeter.
Really?
Yeah.
What'd you do in track?
Shot put and disc.
Yeah.
I would say the discus was my single most rewarding athletic endeavor. I really loved it. Even though I went and played college football for a couple years on scholarship, but I loved throwing the discus.
Colleges came to you in high school when you were playing football?
Yeah, I was recruited mostly, let's see, there was Washington State, University of Idaho, Idaho State, University of Utah, Utah State, to some degree by University of Washington. those were mostly, and then a bunch of junior colleges.
Because let's say for people who don't, or who can't make a picture of you. Well, I congratulate you. You're physically the largest person ever to be on my podcast. And I thought that would never happen. I thought the host of this podcast would always be the big in Big Pop Fun. But in this episode specifically, and maybe from now on, the big has been replaced. Because you're a very, I mean, I'm a big guy, but you're big like my dad was a very big guy.
Oh, yeah?
Yeah. He was big like you? Oh, yeah. My dad was your size. How tall are you?
I'm 6'6", a little over.
Yeah. Yeah.
Wow.
6'6". He was big like you. Like, you're very big.
What was his name?
His name was Tom.
Thomas. Big Tom.
Big Tom.
Were you little Tom?
I was little Tom. And now we're experiencing that now. You know, now at my house, because I have a Tommy. So yeah. So I'm growing up in the house, and I'm little Tom to everyone. And then in high school, I get big. And then my friends are calling, and they say, do you want little Tom or big Tom? And they're saying, he's pretty big. I don't know.
The Tom I'm looking for is pretty big.
Yeah. I'm saying young, maybe. But if he's little Tom, I'd hate to see big Tom. But there was.
I want handsome Tom.
Yeah. There was actually a very big Tom. So you're 6'6", and you were playing really good football. What position?
I was okay.
Kicker? Were you a kicker? Mostly, because I think, you know.
In high school, I was offensive tackle and defensive tackle, and I punted, you know.
You punted, really?
Yeah, I loved punting.
Oh,
yeah,
wow.
Yeah, yeah. But I, in most of the schools that recruited me were giving me the option of offense or defense, and so I in college, I picked defense, which was probably a mistake, but that's okay. It all good.
What does that feel like? I mean, maybe that's a weird question, but to be, because I've never felt that. What is it like to be the big man on campus? To be the athlete where colleges, major colleges, are coming in and saying, "Bill, we'd like to talk to you about coming and, you know, going to our college for free and playing football with us." I mean.
Well, you know, I was so young, and I was young for my age. I didn't turn 18 till I was a freshman in college, you know. And my frame of reference, I didn't fully appreciate it, I suppose. I did in a basic way. I mean, I felt this great burden of, God, I'm being offered a scholarship, and what if I disappoint them, or what if I'm not up to what they...
So there was a lot of nervousness within
the thing. Yeah, 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 feeling that kind of... pressure, you know. But boy, my dad was excited. He loved these coaches coming into our living room and, you know, wooing because they always work the parents. You know,
right? How do they work the parents? I mean, what do they do? It's just
the
politician shtick they're doing.
Absolutely, it's just like sales, you know, And for University of Idaho, where I wound up going, I mean, Ed Troxell, the head coach, actually came to the house. And, you know, Washington State, I think, just sent Bill Cord. I think he was their offensive coordinator. But it's not here or there. But my dad was always tickled by Ed Troxell, who said, hey, February 13th, which was, I think it was February 13th. Was called National Letter of Intent Day, which is when all the high school kids could commit to a college. Mm-hmm. It was the first day. He said, he was hilarious the way he talked. Hey, February 13th, I'm coming to your front door. I'm going to lay down in front of that door. That was really tickled by that, you know. Yeah, and I was excited and nervous. I was mostly nervous. I was mostly nervous just going, you know, there's that terror. It's just like being an actor when you're just like, God, I'm going to be found out, you know.
Oh, that I'm just not as good as those guys over there.
People just have it wrong. Yeah. It's all a mistake.
Were you doing the arts? You were singing?
I was singing, you know, and I really was just singing just because my older brother, who was a real hippie guitar player, you know, early, you know, 60s pothead, had challenged me. He like dared me to try out for the choir in high school. Because I just sing around the house. And so I just did it. And God, next thing I know, I was in this choir. And it was a great choir. And it wound up being just such a great experience. I love choral music. It took me a few years to figure that out. But I really did love it. Yeah.
So when did your attraction to theater or to acting or to doing something other than – you went to college. Did you have designs on being a professional football player?
At first, absolutely. Yeah, absolutely. I had, you know, when I in the early 70s there in high school and being an NFL fan, damn trucks.
How did they get did they drop it from a helicopter down here? How do you get a truck up here?
It's just they never leave the top of the ridge here.
I drove a Honda up here and I had to kill a gazelle on the way.
Late 60s and early 70s was, I think, in some ways a golden age of the NFL. You know, you had John Facenda and the early NFL films, which really, really heightened the stature, the almost mythic status of
the frozen tundra of Soldier Field.
Oh, that's
and good. The Raider offense slashed through the soft underbelly.
It was just such great stuff. But also, I loved watching NFL, and you could identify with the players more then because they weren't, you know, 330 pounds on the line. Mm-hmm. They looked more like real people. But I definitely had that. And then, by my sophomore year in college, I just went, oh, I'm so tired of this. I'm working all year long on being a better lineman. Good Lord, that is boring. And when my knee was blown out in spring ball my sophomore year, I was actually kind of happy.
Was it working out or doing a play or somebody just?
We were doing half line drills and working on being double teamed. And the guard, this funny dude named Dick Wilkins, he just came in low. He just came in low on my left knee. And we were on turf, so you know, your feet just really stick to that stuff. So the knee gave.
But you said it was a relief.
You know what? That night in the hospital, I went, I'm done, and I'm okay with that. And now, actually, I can quit without looking bad because I felt the weight of, I'm on a scholarship. I have to keep, you know.
You can't go to your dad and just say, I just don't like football anymore.
Yeah. So that was cool. And he was, you know, he said, you know, he had actually the same instinct. You know, he said, well, once they've cut on you, well, why don't you just get out and. And the very next fall, I came back to school really not knowing what to do with myself. I had no idea. And this great guy who had also quit, named Chris Beater, we used to sing in the showers after practice and like bug the hell out of people. He came up to me and goes, hey, Willie, they're doing a musical here. We should go try out. And I didn't even know they had a theater department, right? And I said, oh, all right. And it was the show was Godspell, and we both got in. And like by the second week of rehearsal, I went, oh, this is it. You know, I'm loving every second of this process. So, you know,
Never been in Godspell. It's the one show I've wanted to be in since I was about 15 years old. And everyone I know has been in a production of Godspell. Every single I was doing, I was 12 years old, doing Godspell. Right. It's off-broad. What?
Right. Well, it's low budget, you know,
it is.
Musical
it is.
Stuff,
just
but it's
a bunch
real
of kids
people pleasing,
and some,
right. You know. Yeah, it's a lot of fun, a lot of toe tapping numbers.
Yeah.
Yeah, it gets the people going.
So within the second week of Godspell,
yeah.
You're really thinking, wow, this is the thing?
Yeah. Oh, yeah. Before I think I changed my major, and again, I'd already had like three different majors, so. wasn't like I was in pre-med or anything. And Chris Beter, that guy, he's now a judge in Boise.
You mean Beter the quitter?
Yeah, yep. Beter the quitter. Yeah. He is the honor, football quitter. Yeah, the honorable, Chris Beter.
So you changed your major to what, theater?
Uh-huh.
And yeah, you started doing shows.
Yeah, so I got a bachelor's degree in theater and a minor in education and a minor in English. And then I went and got a master's degree in acting down at SMU.
Wow, that's a long way to go.
Yeah, well, I had this. They had this program. It was called the Legal Professional Actor Training Program, and I just thought I'd give it a whirl, and I auditioned for a few programs, and they offered me a fellowship. So I felt like I was kind of late in the game in terms of all the acting stuff. So I went down. It was a 2-year MFA program, which was super intense, but. And SMU was like the opposite of the University of Idaho. Idaho, where the theater classes were in temporary office structures put up during World War I with corrugated tin roofs and stuff. I went to SMU and it's like, marble floors and Rodin sculptures, and one of the most complete collection of Spanish painting in the country is at the arts building there on the SMU campus. So it was definitely a different environment.
So you went... Right from Idaho to SMU?
Uh-huh, yeah. Yeah, and I got the MFA there and then went right to New York.
That's a lot of plays. That's a lot of plays. I mean, between Idaho and SMU for an MFA.
Yeah.
What kind of parts were you playing as a 6'6", very big ex-football player? And I'm only saying this as a 6'3", somewhat smaller than you guy, but who had my own path doing theater – And just getting the part of whatever the big guy could do,
yeah.
Or the stage balancing unit, as I joke, like I'm in a Shakespeare play, and the king and his entire court, like 4 or 5 people are over here, and they're just having me stand over stage left because I balance the scene, and the retinue, the royal party, the king moves stage left. Tom, counter back here. Just look at the maps, Tom. Look at the maps back there, because I'm just this, just a really big guy in some maroon, carpet.
Oh God, yeah, those freaking costumes. Yeah. Yeah, well, it's the same deal. What's certainly I would say set us up well for what to expect in the real business, right?
I would think so.
Yeah, yeah. I mean, because that's
lots of frustration and disappointment. Lots of frustration and disappointment.
That was always the big, yeah.
Why on earth does that? Did the pretty boy who can't act his way out of a paper bag get, the part of Henry?
Right.
Why? Why not? Can I maybe audition for? There are tall people that we can cast. As other roles. There are some tall actresses.
There have been, in history, on rare occasions, tall people who were just like regular people. They just happened to be big. They weren't necessarily...
Fortunately, they didn't look like a big person. They looked like an...
Well, it didn't matter. They were just happened to be... They weren't necessarily dock workers,
right.
or mafia thugs,
yes.
Or... bullies,
yeah.
Or they were just regular people, like perhaps
perhaps you or me, maybe. Yeah, yeah. Perhaps regular people.
Do you think there's ever been a lab technician who is actually 6'5"?
No, isn't that our question? Yeah, I mean, right. For our entire career.
Right.
You're kidding me, right?
Yeah.
Do you want me to go out and find lawyers who are 6'3" tall? Because they're all over the place.
They are
really
there.
They are there.
Yeah.
My dad was a lawyer, and he was 6'6". He was a very, very big man.
Yeah.
Who, anyway.
Anyway.
But you got a lot of parts. Were they mostly mafia goons and, stage balancing units?
Well, because of the singing, some of my best roles, I think, in college were singing roles, like in Little Night Music or Robert Bridegroom, where, it would kind of, my voice allowed, kind of opened that door to be like the lead in Robert Bridegroom. Or
yeah,
whatever.
Sure.
And, but boy, then there was the other stuff. The character stuff was actually like Caliban.
Yeah.
Boy, I got to do a production of Caliban, which was awesome. And,
You do that at SMU?
No, I did that at University of Idaho. Uh-huh. SMU was actually deeply frustrating because it was only a two-year program. They didn't get to do really enough productions there, just a handful, really. I would say my most rewarding performing experience at grad school was probably a special class project. I think, you know, the head acting teacher there, Jack Clay, I think he kind of recognized that I wasn't getting the right kind of opportunities. So he assigned me this special project, which was like four or five scenes from Peer Gynt, you know, which was great. It's not a show that's, you know, done very often. And I was really, in a lot of ways, besides my Nordic background, I was ripe for the role of Peer Gynt. Mm-hmm. So I look back at that now, and that was really the best thing that happened to me performance-wise in grad school. And it was just in class.
And then right out of that, boom, New York City, the whole thing.
Yeah.
Shoulder bag, pictures.
Yeah. A couple of, load up a couple of trunks, put them on the Amtrak, pick them up at Penn Station.
Right. And just get a little apartment. Where did you live?
I was able to sublet from my brother who had been there a few years before.
That's fortunate.
Yeah, I was really fortunate. And I shared it with Nick Bakay. Do you know Nick?
I know Nick, sure.
We actually went to SMU together.
Oh, okay.
And so we shared that apartment, and he was such a hilarious roommate. We had a lot of fun.
Well, Nick's a writer and producer still. Yeah. To people who don't know Nick was actually the voice of the cat on the show Sabrina the Teenage Witch, because he was a writer and a producer on that show.
Yeah, and he wrote Paul Blart Mall Cop.
Great guy.
And then he's done a lot of television work, writing. Yeah. Yeah, good dude.
So you were living with Nick and just trying to get an agent and doing all that stuff.
You know what? I moved to New York. I had done a few jobs that summer after I graduated. You know, I did Summer Shakespeare and also, you know, House Ad, and I also worked a weekend at a donut shop. And I pulled together enough money. After I moved, I knew I had 8 weeks. I had 8 weeks of money before I'd have to get a job in New York. And 6 weeks after I moved there, I got an off-Broadway show.
Really?
Yeah, as a big guy, as a big German thug.
German thug.
Yeah. Sure. And I haven't stopped working since, I guess.
It's really?
Been, yeah, and that was September of 83.
Wow. Because I've been doing it that long, too. And I tell you, I've stopped working often. Often between now and then. I look on my career as sort of semi-retirement. Because it's, you know, there's these periods where I like to look at it as I'm relaxing.
Reflecting.
I'm reflecting.
Sabbatical.
I'm clearing the decks and awaiting the next adventure.
I have a horseshoe about 6 feet up my ass. I had some good fortune.
Wow. Well, so you were a German thug off Broadway because, of course, you're very, at that point, you're a young guy, blondish blonde hair.
Yeah.
Very big.
Right.
The perfect, that young, treacherous Nazi.
Yeah. It was a German thug in a work camp, and there was a lot of stage combat. The name of the play was Last of the Knucklemen, and it was directed by Pete Masterson, who had written and directed Best Little Whorehouse in Texas. And I got to do this big fight scene with Dennis Quaid, who was in the city to do a couple of off-Broadway shows while The Right Stuff was coming out.
Mm-hmm.
And so I got to do this big fight scene with him, and, you know, I basically just went right from there into another off-Broadway show that started the day, rehearsing the day after that one closed. And by the end of that one, I had a commercial agent. And just like, I did a lot of regional theater.
Yeah. You
know, I got to say, I worked in Baltimore and Indianapolis and Hartford.
Were you doing all the, you know, the in New York City, the commercial auditions?
Yes.
Every chewing gum or whatever.
Oh, good Lord.
Yeah, everything.
Yeah, the shower and the shampoo.
Your hair's never looked better, honey, or whatever it is.
My least favorite. No, I had a couple least favorites. Let's see. There was the bite and react.
Yeah.
You bite into the food and react. And the gum, putting the gum in, they actually coach you on how to put the gum in. There's a commercial technique.
With the folding?
You have to fold it with one finger. But, oh, my God, I had a couple commercial experiences and auditions. They were so crazy. It was, it was some restaurant chain. And it was kind of an improvisational setting, and so actor and actress are in there pretending they're at dinner, and they're so happy with the food they're getting at this great value that they stand up and start dancing.
right? And so we just had to improvise that.
Sure.
And so I'm feeling it with this gal. We're dancing, and I thought I'd get frisky, so I picked her up, right? So I picked her up, and I'm kind of swinging her around, and I thought I'd get really frisky, and I thought I'd toss her up in the air. Now, this poor woman, I mean, she had no idea that she was about to be thrown up in the air. And so naturally, she reacted with a certain amount of anxiety, and she actually, her body bucked as I tossed her up in the air right in front of me to catch her. I was just going to toss her up a couple feet and catch her. And her body, she like convulsed, and I lost control of her, and she flew over my head. And she landed on the table behind me. And it was like she broke the table. It was this, it was such a nightmare. And thank God she wasn't hurt. I'm sure it was terrifying for her. And so it took us all. It was Donna DeSetta casting, bless her heart. And it happened to be Donna running the session. And it took us all a couple minutes to recover from that. But Jesus, what a nightmare.
But the important thing, did you get it? I mean, fine. Great. She's uninjured. Fine. Whatever. Good luck, dear. Did I get this?
I'm coming back, right?
Exactly. I got a call back. Bring me a new girl. I could throw a lighter. I don't have to throw the girl. Yeah, thanks very much, Donna. Take care. Take care. Would someone validate her ticket? Back surgery, whatever. Get out of the way. I'm hearing whether I got this commercial.
You got the shot, right? You were rolling that, right?
Exactly.
You could just cut at the when she goes up.
Yeah.
Yeah, that was scary. But another one was the young couple and one of our parents. So there's the older, like the grandparents couple, and then the young couple, and it's a disposable diaper commercial, and I'm holding the doll, right? And it's line between the wife and the grandparents, and then my line was, "And new loves fit even more snugly around little Chrissy's legs." And I couldn't say it without getting a lascivious grin on my face because it was such a horrible, ridiculous thing to say. Who would say fit even more snugly between little Chrissy's legs or around little Chrissy's legs? I couldn't say it. They had to excuse me.
I couldn't finish it.
I couldn't get through the line. I kept laughing. And the first couple of times, everyone's laughing. And then the casting director's going, "Okay, we'll get this one now." And then I finally just, I'm sorry. I can't. I have to. And that was one of those big advertising agencies, too. I never made it back in.
Oh, never went in back in?
Yeah, I never went back
in. Well, people who listen have to. It's impossible to, I think, communicate the number of times that an actor like you, like me, goes out for these kinds of commercials when you're a young actor. Many times, back in those years, many times a day, you know, when you come into town thinking, "I am going to save the American theater as we know it."
Right.
You know, the first Shakespeare play. But when I do it, you know, and then you end up, in my case, my first audition was I'm actually marrying a Volkswagen Rabbit, like the car.
Right, yeah.
Walking down the aisle, holding the door handle.
There you go.
And looking lovingly at the car.
There you go.
"Oh, I'm not sure if I'm making the right decision. But it's sure if I," you know, like kissing the car and everything. And you just say, "Wow, here we are."
Well, I guess I have to hope it's a national network spot.
Exactly,
right?
Exactly.
That was the thing, yeah.
National network, class A use would be on the check.
Yeah.
And that meant that it was on the networks or on Sunday night in prime time, that kind of stuff.
I think I did 50 or 60 auditions before I booked one. And I began to think it was like some kind of weird metaphysical, you know, netherworld I'd entered and would never leave or something, where I just kept auditioning for commercials and never having anything happen, or there was some handshake I didn't know or something. I mean, it was.
Well, I think almost everyone feels that.
Yeah, I'm sure. Yeah,
almost everyone, because I think it's that kind of commercial acting is a numbers game.
Yeah,
you just have to go out a million times and get lucky.
Right. Oh, how about these? Okay, you're a group of guys and you're in a bar and you see a girl. Oh, those are brutal.
And you're standing with five guys.
Five
and you're
guys.
Thinking, how on earth do you act in some way that they will say, "Boy, that guy was memorable." He really, when she came into the bar and he registered surprise.
Yeah, but not off-putting.
Yeah.
Because he's representing our product.
Exactly.
Yeah, but he pops a little bit. But you're surrounded by these five strangers, and you're all trying to out-guy each other. And it, oh God, that was horrible. I hated those.
Or where you get paired with a person and you go outside to work on the copy.
Oh, yeah, and you know,
and the person is just horrible.
You know,
horrible. So, Debbie, did you make this coffee today? Well, Rick, I know that you don't like my other and in the back of your head you're thinking, I drove here from the valley, lady. Are you kidding me?
I rode here. This is in August, and I rode my bicycle down from the Upper West Side in 98-degree
right.
humid.
And they pair me with you?
You, and I have to pretend you're not in the room now or something, or,
right.
or somehow integrate what it is you're not doing
yeah.
to, you know, or something.
So what made you decide to move out of New York?
Well, I got Coach.
Oh, really? You got, yeah. got you got cast out of New York?
Yeah, yeah.
No wonder. Because yeah. I'll tell you a thing about Coach. And I was very new to Los Angeles at that time. But as all of us young actors who are trying to get everything,
yeah.
you know, Coach comes on. And this really big blonde football player guy's on the show. I'm like, wait, how'd this guy get it to Stevie?
Oh,
I don't even know what Coach is. Who didn't tell me that? Who didn't tell me about Coach? So I was just incensed that this thing Coach happened.
Yeah. Right,
and you know,
you see an opportunity.
Oh, sure. You would see yeah. like your agents going, well, how does this not pass by my transom when everyone is saying, you know what, you should play a football player on the TV show,
right.
and I don't know. And then there's this guy who's. You know, happens to be great at it, but that's beside the point.
well,
that was a great thing. I mean, to be doing theater and commercials and then get a series that gets picked up and ends up doing
yeah.
very well.
Yeah, yeah. That really just kind of, it was kind of a second tier pilot for ABC. And, well, okay, we'll do 12 episodes. And, you know, we were a mid-season pickup 2 years in a row, which is... very difficult, and then obviously we got very lucky with the they put us in behind Roseanne after it was remember Chicken Soup
with no,
the Jackie Mason remember the Jackie Mason sitcom with Redgrave with Vanessa or Lynn who is it Lynn Redgrave
I think I vaguely remember, but one thing that yeah. wouldn't happen for a Jackie Mason sitcom, I would not think, why didn't I get that? Chicken Soup, an old Jewish guy complaining about life in America? They don't see me for that? So you ended up, I mean, that was, you did Coach for a long time.
9 years.
Nine years.
9 years and 200 episodes.
And for people who didn't see it, it was Craig T. Nelson.
Jerry Van Dyke.
Jerry Van Dyke. Shelley Fabre.
Shelley Fabre.
Yourself.
Claire Carey.
Yeah.
Ken Kimmons, a lovely character actor.
Yeah.
God bless him. Yeah.
And it was a really good show, and you were great in it.
Well, thank you.
You really, I mean, did you have fun doing that?
Oh, God, yeah. I mean, Jerry, there was a special chemistry between Jerry and Craig that was, and a lot of those scenes where I just got to participate in
yeah.
that. You know?
Jerry was, I've only met Jerry a couple times, you know, it was like a Hollywood-y thing, like a dinner-ish thing. But boy, he's always been such a great guy.
Oh, sure.
To me and to Caroline at these places. He's just a wonderful person.
He is the opposite of show business.
Yeah.
He really is. He is completely this. I won't say he's like a real person just because he's not. Because he's got that crazy, you know, comic thing that. It just flows out of him like water.
Oh, I can't repeat it here with you, but you know, there's this story of being on Ed Sullivan because he got an award in he was in the Air Force to make an incredibly long story that's incredibly funny short. He won some contest for, you know, like a military talent show.
Uh-huh.
And the prize was, you're going to be on the Ed Sullivan Show.
Right.
So he had an entire skit where he's wearing various hats that are off a table and playing various characters and everything. And the, you know, the scene is, say, 5 or 6 minutes long. You know, and he's not a professional actor. He's a guy from the military and gets to the Ed Sullivan Show. And they said, for whatever, we have a Topo Gigio bit and this guy's coming out. So we have to make your bit 3 minutes. You know, we have to cut it in half.
Wow.
And it's kind of through line. I mean, it's an entire scene.
Yeah,
like,
right,
what do you not do now?
So and he's Ed Sullivan.
Right.
Which is
he's
the
sweating
biggest,
bullets to put it together. Yeah, and then you're trying to duct tape it in your head. What should I not do and everything? So he gets rid of some hats and he's doing this. I'll do it this way. He's in the middle of the routine. It's going well on the Ed Sullivan Show. And Ed Sullivan himself comes to just outside where the camera frame is. So the camera can't see him, but Jerry Van Dyke can see Ed Sullivan. And Ed Sullivan is going like, stretch. Go longer. And so he's in the middle of a routine on the Ed Sullivan Show, you know, whispering to Ed Sullivan, bring me my hats. Get me my other hats. But I mean, those are the kind, but he had a million of those things.
Right.
A million of those things. I mean, playing the banjo, all kinds of stuff.
Right. Yeah.
But I just thought, what a terrific guy.
Yeah. Yeah. Great. Yeah. I just, talked to him not too long ago. Hopefully I'll see him in a couple of weeks.
Yeah. Yeah, was, is he out in the desert or something? Is he?
Well, he spends a lot of time in Arkansas.
Does he?
His wife is from Arkansas.
Uh-huh.
So they have a place there, and he's got a place down in Mexico, but I don't know how much he's there now.
So when you're on a TV show, even when you're getting along with the people and the show is good, as it was on Coach, does a time come in, like a long run of a Broadway show, like when you're doing something every day, did it ever start to turn? Not to get bad, but did you? Was there a point where you said, okay, like football, I think I'm about done with this?
Well, no.
Or do you just say, hey, this is a show that's going well, so stay on it. Keep it going.
Well, there's certainly, you want to, you know, have growing up with, you know, my parents and their sensibility about making money and, you know, working and all that stuff. I was just like, yeah, you make hay while the sun shines.
Sure.
So, you know, creatively, you reach a point where, okay, I'm done. I'm done with the setup joke.
Right.
Setup joke. Setup joke. And it's always the same kind of, you know, kind of material and the same kind of stuff. You know, despite, you know, some really great writing that I got to work with. But that was 9 years, you know, so that's, you know, you're not mentally conditioned to do anything as a performer that long.
Right, right.
You know, maybe a few weeks, maybe in a freakish circumstance you do a play for a few months, but that's like never happened. So I was doing this one character for 9 years, and so yeah, you get a little burned out there. And after when Coach wrapped, I was like, I don't want to do a sitcom for a long time. I have to do other stuff. And you know, but that being said, you know, once after a little bit, I love sitcoms and I love comedy. So that's my comfort zone, I think.
Now, a while ago, you and I had this conversation, but I wonder if you could use this public forum to disabuse other actors of the idea that if a show runs for that many years, I mean, you are made.
You are set. Oh, you're set. You never
and
have
just
to.
Like an aircraft carrier full of cash
comes to a dock
for you once a week about, where do I put all this cash? Exactly.
God, another storage bin.
It becomes the problems of your life just becomes counting.
Oh, stacking and rubber bands. And no.
Is it like that, Bill, who was on a show for nine years?
I can tell you absolutely, when you're in the midst of a successful television operation, you'll be making probably more money than you will ever make again. Because, you know, barring movie stars, which is a very small group, regular television is certainly lucrative, and it's and that's great. However, it is very extremely temporary. It is finite, and you know what's interesting? One of the real learning experiences for me was syndication, because that was like this, you know.
Right. Well, the same thing. Then to everyone.
Golden cow.
Oh, your show went into syndication.
Oh, syndication, you're set.
Just
you're
buy set. Champagne yeah, and yeah, just yeah. live in diapers.
Yeah.
Just whatever.
Just hire people.
Yeah. Just hire people and
I had
splash
that
in the ocean.
From everyone. People in the business, out of the business. That's the crazy thing, too, is people out of the business. You walk into a mall in Minneapolis, and someone will go, hey, that show's on syndication, and wink at you. And it's this phenomenal misconception. I walked into an audition once about
2 years after Coach, and the casting director was walking me in, and she was going, "Why are you doing this for?" And they didn't understand that, okay, first of all, syndication, what it is it's a formula based on SAG, on the SAG scale.
Screen Actors Guild is a union of performers.
Yeah, the labor minimum scale for that medium, in that case sitcoms, and you get a percentage of that minimum scale when it goes into syndication. Just to cut to the basics of it, the first 2 years of syndication it's great. You are grossing there anywhere from like 150 to 200,000. That's great, obviously.
That's good, yeah.
That's terrific. Within about 7 years, it keeps decreasing every year, and in about 7 years it reaches its floor, which is about, well, for Coach, I still get I guess I get about $7,000 or $8,000 a year.
You can live on that, Bill.
Exactly.
What are you complaining about?
I want a Jaguar in every primary color. Yeah. And certainly that's lovely to have some mortgage payment help there. And yeah. Great. But when that's the reality and complete strangers are coming up to you leering at you, right, and you're actually getting letters in the mail from complete strangers asking for $20,000.
Yes.
It is a very peculiar situation.
So what you would say is it's good, if not great. Hey, it's great, but it's simply not what people think that it is.
It's not what exactly right. And I think what almost all actors that find themselves in a television series have to deal with is now I'm in my second year of the series and it's going, and holy cow, I'm making $250,000 a year. I'm going to buy a house.
Right.
And get a nice car, and I'll get married, and I'll have a kid, and now you are living right up to that too. You're spending that $250,000.
You're spending as if you were going to live this way.
And then wait a minute, the next year I got a raise. Next year I'm getting $320,000. Let's renovate this, and then the show runs for 5 years or whatever, and then the show ends, and now you experience a very specific feeling of your income drops by 90% to 95%, but you're living up to, there should be classes in there or something. You got to plan ahead.
I was very fortunate in being a bouncer at the Comedy Store that I've talked about on the show before, because early on, I mean, I was a kid, I was a big kid, so they gave me the job as bouncer and I could get spots at the Comedy Store.
Uh-huh.
But as a job, I saw everybody doing their sets. I saw so many guys go, "I got a pilot. Hey, good news. That's great. My pilot got picked up." The day after the pilot gets picked up for, let's say, 6 episodes, the guy drives in a Corvette.
Wow.
Even then, and I was a kid thinking, boy, I would probably like open a bank account or something. Yeah. Like saving. I mean, you never know. You know, might not. And then, like clockwork, show gets canceled. Corvette gets repossessed. Guy is back with all of us at the Comedy Store trying to get spots as a stand-up.
Yeah.
You know, so I saw that cycle happen over and over. So, boy, I never bought a Corvette.
Right.
Yeah. I just sort of open a bank account and lay low.
Yeah, right.
Lay low.
Yeah, really think of the long game, because you're in an extraordinary circumstance where really your only skill is dancing monkey. And you have little reason to expect that you're going to make that kind of money until you retire. So just hang on to your hat and go out for dinner and maybe have a nice trip here or there, and maybe, but just try and be smart.
So you should be a dancing monkey with a change purse. Just hold something in there.
Right.
Have a wallet, some kind of a dancing monkey 401k. Wow. So what, after we met doing voiceovers. We met on Gargoyles.
Oh, absolutely, yeah.
I was doing Matt Bluestone on that. I know, forgettable.
Did you ever do an episode of Dumb and Dumber, the animated series?
I may have. Somebody.
I just wondered if I saw you before Gargoyles.
I think, I don't know. Yeah, if I okay, whether so I don't sure. remember.
Okay. Yeah.
So people who listen to this, I'm sure I'll get an email saying which episode it was or what right. you know, who was in the episode, the title of the episode. But I'm not sure. But I think
so. Yeah, it would have been Gargoyles.
So you you started with Dumb and Dumber, or what? You know, what began the process? Because you have a distinctive voice, and you mm-hmm. certainly within the characters you played in animation have made it, you know, even more distinctive. Right. When did that start? Was that from you or from somebody saying, you know, you should try this? God,
you know, it's just one of those crazy deals where I got a call from a new agent that I'd just signed up with, who. And she goes, hey, they just sent out a breakdown for a cartoon, and they want a dog who sounds like Dauber, which was my character on Coach.
Oh, yeah, yeah.
And I went, well, and I hadn't auditioned, really, you know, for I don't think, hardly any animation. And I went, okay, but I'm not just going to do Dauber, okay?
Yeah.
You
yeah.
know, I did that whole thing,
right.
kind of being protective. But then I thought, as I went in for it, I thought, oh, my God, what... What if I don't get it? God, that'd be depressing. You know? But I got it. And it was only ran for 1 year, and it was an animated series based on Beethoven.
Mm-hmm.
And Joel Murray played Beethoven, the what was that, St. Bernard. And I was Caesar, the Great Dane. And then there were some other interesting people. I remember Joey Pantaleone was on that. As the streetwise little mutt.
Mm-hmm.
And that kind of opened that door to, as you know, is a fairly enclosed world. It's not hermetically sealed. People do kind of drift in and out around the periphery of television animation.
But yes, but there are a few staple guns at the edge of it.
Yeah.
It's not hermetic, but yeah. it's pretty,
yeah,
you
it's,
know.
It's fairly tight. Yeah.
How'd SpongeBob happen?
well, he had already cast Tom Kenny as SpongeBob. He'd worked with Tom on Stephen Hillenburg, I should say, the creator of SpongeBob. I think he'd worked with him on Rocko's Modern Life, and he'd heard this character that Tom did, this kind of high pitched character, and he worked with Tom, and so he already had Tom, and he had this, you know. One of those old school style cassette decks that he had, he came in, brought into the session, and wasn't in a studio or anything. It was like in a conference room, the auditions. And I think he had, I might be wrong here, but I think Hillenburg may have, I think he might have heard Beethoven. Maybe heard some of the voices on Beethoven. I could be wrong, but anyway, he basically just played Tom, and he said, we're looking for the friend of SpongeBob, and so I hear the SpongeBob, this insane-sounding character, and so, okay, low and slow, that's my deal, that's our deal.
Yeah,
and,
yeah.
You know, and so I just did the thing, and, you know, and when I first heard it, I just thought it was just some goofy preschool thing, you know, who's ready, who's ready? It's like, why is he saying it twice? Oh, it must be for four-year-olds. Okay, so they like to hear things repeat,
right.
You know. And then we shot the pilot, and then I saw the pilot, and I just went, oh, my God, this is such a great little cartoon. Oh, please let this not get screwed up, you know, by, you know, someone not recognizing how great it was. But, yeah.
When did you realize that it was just such an incredible phenomenon?
Well, the first thing was just seeing the potential. And they sent us all, which is very unusual. We all got a copy of the pilot before Nickelodeon had decided to pick it up, even. They just sent it to us. It was like a 7 or 8 minute episode.
Mm-hmm.
And I did my own testing because I wanted to see if it was just, maybe it was just me. And so, you know, so I showed it to my girls. Girls loved it. They at the time were like, you know, 4 and 6 or
right.
something like that. And, anytime a family would come over with kids, I'd say, sit down for a minute. We've got some. And, you know, they would always love it. So I thought, okay, this is special. And then I guess once it went on the air, and by the time it went on the air, my girls were in, I believe, 2nd grade and kindergarten, perhaps 3rd and 1st. Well, I was 99. So, yeah, it was 2nd grade and kindergarten. So when my appearances at the school to pick the kids up after school, well, it became like, Moses.
right.
I thought, and that was early on, really before the show really taken off, but the kids that had seen it, their reaction to the characters, and as they heard that, oh, Hannah's dad was, you know, this working is, on it.
Yeah.
I thought, this is not like any other cartoon I've worked on. And then you're just hoping, you know, I mean, something can be great, but if it doesn't get the right kind of management by a network, it doesn't matter.
Oh, right.
It doesn't matter how good it is. If people don't tend it or let it grow on its own, or, and of course with animation, it's so important for the economics of cable television and for animation. Merchandise is so important, you know.
Yeah.
It's not just ratings. It's not just commercial revenue, advertising revenue. They got to sell merchandise.
The Happy Meal toys and board games and every kind of thing. Huh?
And, and pencils and macaroni and cheese. And
has that work? Has it afforded you interesting experiences around the show? Or do people not know, not associate you so much with the show? Does that make sense?
Over the last 2 to 3 years, it's much more a thing where the people that recognize me from Coach now know about SpongeBob.
Right,
before
right.
it used to be completely separate. Mm-hmm. It was only like real fans of the show that would watch behind the scenes stuff that would recognize me. You know, really, truly the most wonderful thing about the job, well, not one of the truly wonderful things about the job is show's been on the air since 99. So really any person between the ages of like 28 and 6, I can make them smile mm-hmm. or laugh. It's incredible.
Yeah, yeah.
It is so, all I got to do is, hey, I like your hat. And they laugh, you know, it's an incredible, joyous kind of thing. And I can connect with kids, and I love kids. That's the key. I love kids. And the fact, and I can connect with kids and I don't get stonewalled by, you know, the aloof 9-year-old. I can just like do a little Patrick and suddenly I have as much conversation as I want. It's really fun. I love that. The younger ones are the funny, like the 4-year-olds, they're kind of strange because if I do Patrick to a 4-year-old, they're just as likely to look at me with irritation and be kind of perplexed and kind of a vibe of, shut up. You're not Patrick. Right. Stop trying to talk like Patrick. Yes. You're not Patrick, you big goofball. You know, and
well, to a 4-year-old, you are a something like an office building. I mean, you're just like,
why is this Quonset Hut
exactly? Trying to Quonset Hut walked up to me and starts doing Patrick Starfish voices. And what have you been doing lately? You're doing a lot of episodes of the show. They're still doing the show.
Still doing the show, thanks goodness. And we're going to do another movie, which I think we'll start production, voice production in November, December. They want a 2014 release, so we'll have to get going on that, I guess, fairly soon. And I've been doing whatever camera. I mean, you know, it's hard to get camera work, and I had a nice little deal on How I Met Your Mother. That was really.
You certainly did, and I almost forgot that another one where I always marvel at you when I see you on is The Artist.
Oh, yeah.
I'm watching The Artist, and there's Bill. I'm like, I didn't know The Artist was taking place. How do you get – you didn't even have to say anything. How do you get in a silent movie?
Oh, my God, dude. That was one of those things. I tell you, that was so funny that there were, you know, the manager calls. Oh, yeah, there's this French guy who does – you know, he's done a silent movie. He wants to do another silent movie. You know, I don't know if you want to read for this thing. There's scribbles on his script, blah, 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 blah. And, you know, there's this one – the audition scene they were using was this very scene at the very top where the lead character were watching him in a movie get tortured. And it was like the torturers. That was the scene they were using. And it was this, and I read this script and I went, this is cool. It's a silent movie. And who knows? It was just all minimum. Right. Just everything was just scale, negative scale, you know. So, I'll go in. It was in some strange room, like in one of those multi-purpose casting, central casting places where you got Colgate, Ford.
Right.
and then yeah. you know,
for those who people don't know, it'll yeah. be so what some kind of industrial building, yeah. and you go into a giant vestibule thing. Yeah, that's
yeah,
it.
Yeah,
it's and a Colgate commercial this way, room two.
Yeah,
the and, artist, you know, silent movie, Academy Award winning thing.
Oh, there was no sign.
Room three.
There was no sign.
No sign.
There was just Prell and Colgate, and you know, and what all these different products, and it's packed, and kids are running all over the place, and I'm going, what the hell is this? And I'm going, does anyone know anything about a movie? And finally, one dad went, I think there might be something there. There's this closed door. There wasn't a sign or anything. And I'm waiting. I'm sitting there a half hour. No one else. I'm asking, anyone here? It's people would, adults would walk down and say, you here for the movie? No. No, I'm here for the Ford Escort.
Or right.
And so I would say, okay. I say to myself, 5 minutes and I'll just leave. And 5 minutes, okay. I just go to the store. I open the store. I say, listen, is this an audition? And there are two or three people surround the table. And they go, oh, are you here for? Oh, yeah, yeah. Come on in. Okay. So I go in and I do this thing. And I do, you're just improvising, right? Because you know the beats of the scene. Mm-hmm. There's no dialogue. And I do the improv. Walk out. Didn't think again. And then manager calls me. They want to use you. They want to do a cop. They want you to do a cop. What? Oh, okay. I didn't audition for a cop. Yeah, I know, but they got this cop scene. And she told me the scene. I went, oh, that's kind of a neat little scene. And cool, great. And okay, it works one day, you know, so you're getting $500 one day.
Yeah.
And man, it was on Paramount lot, and they dressed that old city section so nice, and all the background, walking out with their great 30s, you know, 1930 mm-hmm. costumes, and they got about 25 20s era cars going blah, 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 blah,
right
blah, 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 up and down the road, and it's MOS, right, meaning without sound. So they got speakers up and they're just blaring 20s era music all day.
Really?
It was the coolest working environment.
Wow.
It was so neat. And here I have this intense little scene with this magnificent actor where he is coming unglued. You know, his sanity is being pushed to the edge. And we shoot the scene all day. And he is bringing it every take. And I don't have any dialogue. But the scene is about me talking to him.
Mm-hmm.
So I got to ad-lib and create dialogue all day. And I did not want to give him the same shit all day. I wanted to be able to give him.
So you were you were talking.
I mean, you
were talking aloud in order that he would be reacting to what you said.
Absolutely.
As he was absolutely down on his luck.
Yeah.
And you're trying to see what's wrong or to help him.
Yeah, and I'm the old school, you know, the cop on the beat.
Right.
And I'm trying to get a reaction out of this guy. I'm just trying to talk to him and engage him. And I wanted it to be germane. I mean, he's delivering this beautiful performance every take. I go, I got to, you know, I can't beat some dick and just say the same thing over and over.
Right.
So I had to keep creating these backstories and these scenarios and this, you know, this history of my relationship with this tuxedo shop and the whole thing. And all day, sorry, it was a really interesting, crazy, different day. You know, and then, you know, everybody saw the reaction to it and the way people responded to it.
Oh, yeah.
And stuff.
But well, that was quite a day.
I assure you, Tom, I assure you, had anyone in town had any idea what kind of product was going to happen, I would not have been within 2 miles of an audition. It would have been, you know, then my manager begging me to, you know, begging them to let me in to, you know.
Oh, of course.
You know what I'm saying? Yeah.
I'm sure. Yeah.
My role would have been played by, you know, James Gandolfini or something.
Right.
Yeah,
no,
yeah.
Whatever.
Yeah, right. Yeah.
Matt Damon wants to be the cop. What?
Right.
It's one day. He just wants to do it.
He's got an opening and, you know. Yeah, right.
But you improvised all day. That's good. That's professional.
It was just such a great experience, and so it was so much more gratifying than being the grieving dad in a CSI or whatever.
Right.
You know what I mean.
And having respect for the art that both he was doing, the director was doing, and of the piece itself. That's great.
Yeah.
That's great. So what? I've already taken up too much of your time. You have to go.
No, but I think
I try to ask people what they would say to that young person who's trying to come into the business, into theater, into acting, into voiceover. But let me be specific with you because I haven't been able to do it yet. What would you tell the really big guy who's out there and thinking, you know, it's impossible? Because I've had that conversation with that young actor who's my size,
right,
and I've had to say, like, I am always hopeful and I think you should follow your dream.
Yes.
But you really need to know what you're getting into.
Yes.
And know the difficulty that's in front of you.
Yes.
Because a lot of things will be closed off to you.
Yeah.
You will not be in a tuxedo, you know, dancing with that lady with the
right.
four other guys.
Right.
You know, you just will not do that.
Right.
You know, you will not get the girl. You will be choking her as a guy hits you with a 2x4.
Right. You will not be the surgeon.
Yeah.
You'll be the guy getting
right. You will not catch
up.
A criminal.
Yeah.
The actual criminal fighter guy will lift you up with wires and throw you into a bunch of trash cans. That's what will happen.
Right.
So what do you say to the young person who comes up to you, you know, stars in their eyes, hungry to do it?
Well,
do you have recommendations?
Yes. They're first and foremost with anyone coming into our business, and this is the most challenging thing, is you have to be resolved not to let the business define your sense of self-esteem. The business is too enigmatic and cynical. You have to create your self-esteem from other places, from within, from whatever, what other things you do that are important to you, that you enjoy, whatever. You cannot look to the business to affirm you. That has to come from yourself. And then the other, in terms of type, you know, I remember there was a guy when I was in graduate school, Patrick Tucker from the Royal Shakespeare Academy came over and he was doing a workshop with us. And someone asked him about stereotypes and how you fight against stereotypes. And he just, in that wonderful British kind of sensibility, practical way, he just went, "Oh, why would you fight it? Embrace it. Master it. Let it lead to something else." And that really stuck with me for obvious reasons, because I was sitting there at 6'6". And so I've always wanted to be, since, you know, and you know this, you know, you go to an audition, you're sitting around a bunch of guys that are vaguely and, you know, like you. And
right.
I wanted to do as good a dumb guy as I could. I wanted to put as much heart into that stupidity as I
right.
could, or whatever. You know, you want to bring everything to that.
Of course.
Don't let the feeling of a limited concept of a character limit you and what you bring right. to it.
And as you're saying, look, and I've told people, there's a lot of intellectual work behind creating a dumb character.
Right.
There
yeah.
really is.
Yeah.
Because a dumb character does not think he is dumb.
Right.
He thinks he is smart, and he doesn't understand why no one else thinks in the way that he thinks.
He just sees things differently.
He sees things differently.
Yeah, yeah.
And the confusion is not because I am dumb. The confusion is because why doesn't everyone see this?
Right, yeah. Yeah.
You know?
Yeah, exactly. Yeah.
But as you were saying that, it just reminded me, I was in a play, and it was a musical, and we were dancing, and there was a big guy in the cast like me.
Uh-huh.
Maybe a bit taller than me, and he was dancing, and we kept doing it over and over. The choreographer was unhappy with it, and she stopped everyone and she went up to him. I won't say his name, but she said, "You are afraid of being big."
Oh, that's great.
You know, and this was a tiny woman.
Wow,
you know,
right?
And I yeah. said, "Wow, that's good." She said, "You are dancing like you're afraid that someone's going to find out that you're big."
Big, wow.
I have news for you. You are big. And that's wonderful. And I want to see the wonder and passion of you being big and dancing.
Wow.
You know?
That's great.
It was just fabulous.
And you and I both know exactly what she's talking about.
Exactly. Yeah. Exactly. And, you know, and from that point, I loved her from that point
yeah,
on.
Because sure.
she was right on the money.
Yeah.
Just right
oh,
on the
man.
Money.
That's, yeah, that's great. And in theater, you have that luxury. You know, and
right?
Then, yeah, which is great. My first big Camera job was secret of my success, or as I like to call it, secretions of my excess. And my very first shot in the movie was me leaning up against the wall, you know, with my arm outstretched, leaning against a wall, and Michael J. Fox walking under the arm. Right? Mm-hmm. You may have done the same shot. But I remember, like, the next day or maybe a couple days later, the cinematographer, this one of those little crazy brilliant guys from Central Europe, comes up to me and goes, you're very tall. It's good for you. It's bad for me. Step out of the shot, please.
Yes.
How many? I can only imagine the numbers of times, because as people know, that an actress or an actor would be standing on a half apple box and you'll be in your socks.
Does that happen? Oh, yeah.
A half apple box, for people who don't know, these wooden boxes that are used to support things, support the camera and everything, and people can stand on them as well to give them maybe 4 or 5 inches of height.
Well,
on
a full half apple.
A full apple
is like 6-ish.
Is it?
What is a full apple?
A little higher than that. Yeah, 80, full apple, 8, 10.
Yeah.
A half apple just gives so.
There are quarter apples.
Yeah. Oh, yeah.
Yeah.
So many things I have acted just in my socks.
Yeah. You know? Yeah. Yeah. And when you find yourself, which I always hate, when I find myself kind of doing what the guy in the play was
shrinking.
You're just shrinking yourself because you know you're a problem. You know?
Right.
It's that feeling you get when you get to a movie theater, right, and you're a little late and the theater's full, but there are the two seats right there, and you sit down and you hear the person behind you go, oh.
How many times?
Exactly.
You go,
oh, God.
So oh.
That's such a weird thing, a vibe to have, to care. First of all,
well, that like we still care. Yeah. You still care.
Yeah. There are the guys that wouldn't care. Like, screw you. All this,
right.
You know.
I tried to scrunch down. Yeah, exactly. By the end of one of my kids' plays,
like
I have back spasm because I'm scrunching down trying to give everyone a view.
Right.
But sometimes, you know, like getting on a plane and sitting down next to the person and just going, this is how it is, buddy.
You see, you're headed towards your seat.
Exactly.
And you see the person looking at you going,
as their jaw drops to the ground. Yes.
Please don't sit in the... Oh.
No. Yeah. Right. Yeah. Yes, it's me.
Yes, it's
Lucky
me.
Row 17. How about that?
And then you take the exit row, right? Because you think you're going to have more room. And you realize, exit row is like the place for broken toys or huge toys. And, oh, no, I'm sitting in a row with two other guys like me. This isn't working.
Just all looking at each other going, oh, you've got to be kidding. Who invited the rugby team to fly to Miami? Oh, well, it's great spending time with you, Bill. You're one of my favorite guys. You're on the ultimate good guy squad.
Oh, it's been too long.
You've always been so kind. And thanks for being on. I really appreciate it.
You bet, man. This
now,
is fun.
Do you to get out of here? Do you rappel? Do you rappel down to a staging area?
We actually have Sherpas that will guide.
Oh, good,
you down.
Good. Yeah. Thank you very much. I appreciate it, buddy. Thanks. Bill Fagerbucky, Fagerbucky, Fagerbuck, or add your own umlaut. As you can hear, Bill is quite an artist of real experience and gravitas. Thanks so much for listening. I really appreciate it. Hey, would you tell a friend? Consider subscribing. I'm having a wonderful adventure with this, and I'm really gratified and amazed at the reaction. So I thank you. Hey, thanks Emily Wilson for producing. Thanks to Chris and Katie, everybody at Nerdist Industries for their help. Thanks to McPherson Guitars, the great guitar company, and Dane Markley Strings for helping me so much on my live show. But thanks to you especially. This is a wonderful adventure for me, and as you can hear by the song, I still don't know what I'm doing. But we're having fun, aren't we? Hey, we'll see you next time. Bye.
Now leaving Nerdist.com.